there are just times we find there's a lot of audiologists and clinicians in audiology that have hearing loss. And there are times where it seems like the personal experience can in some ways be projected onto the patient and potentially get in the way of the care of that patient. How are you mindful of that with your experience to recognize when your lived experience can be beneficial to the road that the patient needs to travel versus when it could potentially be disruptive?
That's a really good question. And I'm glad that you brought that up because I have experienced that myself, like in working with my own providers. And I've found that sometimes providers will project their own almost like traumas onto their patients. So I've had like, oh, you're probably never going to be able to eat XYZ because they can't do that thing. And so I've become very aware of how that has dysregulated my own nervous system. And so I think with my patients, I try to check in with myself and offer, not necessarily say, this is what works for me. And that means it's the only thing that's going to work for you, but like to offer them more general things, to have them try things and report back and say, how did you do with it? To say, here's something I've seen in my clinical practice. I try to compare like my own experience with sort of like the clinical data like that I've collected in my head over time too, of like, talk to your doctor about this, ask what their clinical experience has been. So I try not to be, I guess, too stringent or like dogmatic about anything, but it definitely is a risk to work with a provider who has personal experience with it. And I think there will always be a bias kind of inherently, but I do try to be mindful of that because I've seen that work negatively on me as a patient.
Is there a general timeline as to how long patients tend to work with you, or is it case by case dependent?
I think it totally depends on the patient. I'm sure that's not the answer that you wanted. I would say in general, I meet with people, I would say for 4 to 6 weeks, and then we do like biweekly. So we might do that for, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months, and then do like monthly. But it depends on how they're doing, and it depends on how much help they need on the medical side too, because I find some patients need a lot of like, I saw the doctor and I only talked to them for 15 minutes and I have all this information and I don't know what any of it means. And so sometimes I find myself being, I don't want to say like a case manager, but like almost helping try to make sense of all the other
unpacking it all with them.
Yeah. So that can make things kind of take a bit longer because we're not just focused on like the behavioral health piece. But I would say in general, I'll say an average of maybe like 16 sessions. With that said, there are definitely people who are like, I don't ever want to leave you and I want to see you forever. And so there's that kind of cohort too.
Do you ever work specifically with tinnitus patients? Because as I'm listening to you talk, mm-hmm. It would seem like there's also a lot of overlap, or there could potentially be overlap with the management of patients with tinnitus and the management of a vestibular disorder, because both are sensations that can be difficult for somebody to describe and also difficult for somebody to not focus on and divert their attention from.
I have. I will say though, it's mostly been in the context of vestibular disorders though. So like, I've seen someone post superior canal dehiscence surgery who developed a very severe tinnitus and like sound distortion. So like that's one that kind of comes to my mind from recently. Or when they have a vestibular migraine attack, they get warm tinnitus or Meniere's. I rarely get people who like their only presenting concern is tinnitus. However, with that said, a lot of the same principles apply of like, how do we make sense of this from a nervous system perspective? How do we downregulate like attention? How is the neuroplasticity piece playing into this? I think it also depends on the cause or like the onset, the etiology, if you want to put it that way, of the tinnitus. But so yes, I'm very aware of tinnitus. However, that's rarely like the clean presenting concern for me in my practice.
We like to say that we have patients with tinnitus and tinnitus patients. And for the tinnitus patients that come in, we often do questionnaires to see how severe their symptoms are affecting quality of life. Mostly to see if we need to refer out for any sort of mental health evaluation for them, since that's outside our scope. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sort of questionnaires with your vestibular patients, or any sort of metric to see, is it so debilitating for them that they need more psychiatric care or anything like that?
For tinnitus specifically?
Oh, no, for vestibular.
Oh, for vestibular. My kind of basic vestibular questionnaires are the GAD-7, PHQ-9, DHI, kind of like the standard ones. And I honestly don't necessarily find them that helpful, because I feel like, especially with depression and some of like the vegetative symptoms, there's like some overlap with vestibular disorder. So it's like, is this measuring depression or is this measuring the vestibular symptoms? I do try to keep some level of objective assessment though, just to see how people are doing. But I would say over time, I've put less emphasis on that and more emphasis on like how they're functioning and how they're more subjectively describing quality of life. And yeah.
One of the things we've liked to ask the people that we've spoken to is, what could we be doing better? So oftentimes in the healthcare space, prior to mental health intervention, the audiologist is the provider that has the most time to spend with the patient who's experiencing the vestibular dysfunction. That what do you think audiologists could or should be doing better to service their patients? And also, how should audiologists be thinking about introducing the mental health care component to the overall treatment for the patient?
Mm-hmm. A few things come to mind for like what could be incorporated. I would say the number one thing, and maybe this seems obvious and you're doing this already, but is just validation of the patient's experience. So no matter what they're saying, that is true for them. So whether you're like, this doesn't make sense or whatever, like validate their emotional experience. And then maybe you might present the data and how that's in contrast or whatever. But just saying, I hear you, I believe you, you know, I'm listening to you, because we've been brushed off by so many people. The other thing I would say is to think holistically, because I find that so many doctors, it's like, are so siloed in their specialty, and they think these things are not related, and they are so related. So one thing that comes up a lot in my practice is a lot of people who come to me have Hashimoto's hypothyroid, and they're like, is this related? And I'm like, definitely. Like, so many people come to me with this, and I've heard time and again, people see neurologists and ENTs, know that those things are not related. It's like the body does not work in isolation. Like there's an inflammatory component to the autoimmune piece. There's an inflammatory component to the migraine piece and whatever else, Meniere's. And so I would say thinking more holistically about how the systems work together, which is, I think, a big hole in the system at this point. And then what was your last question?
When we're introducing the mental health care component to the conversation, how and when should we be thinking about that? Because typically it's coming up when it's like, wow, I feel like I can't give you what you need. I can't get you to where you need to be. Now I need to refer you out to this additional provider.
I think my question would be, so typically for you, how many times are you seeing the patient, and like, what's the cadence of that? Like, is it a one-time thing and you have to like kind of like throw it all in? Then are you seeing them repeatedly? Is there time to build rapport?
It's probably going to depend on the setting that the specific audiologist is in, but most of the time it's going to be a one and done type of appointment where you're coming in, we're taking a really long history. We might then be doing some diagnostic testing. And then we're saying, okay, either we're going to report on this in a week and it'll tell you what to do, or we're saying at that point, hey, this is what I think your next step should be. Take it from there.
Sometimes we run into the issue of our tests are not necessarily capturing what they're coming in for. Yeah. And then we didn't capture it, so we can't say it's an audiology vestibular issue that we're able to measure, but what do we do now?
Or it might be like, hey, none of your other providers have ever brought up the idea of vestibular migraine, but your symptoms you're describing seem so spot on. ask your provider about this because I can't technically make that diagnosis, but I have a high suspicion that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. So we want to try and direct or steer them in a certain way sometimes.
Yeah. I have lots of thoughts on that, and I'm sure I'll talk and then lose my train of thought, but I'll try to remember all of it. So I would say I'll talk about what I think the gold standard would be, and then I'll talk about what I think realistically most people could do in their practices. Sure. The gold standard would be to have behavioral health co-located in the same clinic. And when I say that, I mean, so this is where my background is. I worked in integrated primary care for multiple years. Patients are much more likely to destigmatize, to be more likely to come back, to follow up. If you were to have a psychologist in the next room and be like, hey, Joe Smith, let me introduce you to so-and-so, and they can take it from here. So that warm handoff model, which exists, I would say, like in pain clinics, the VA uses it a lot. I don't know how much it's really trickled into like other areas, but I think that would be kind of best case scenario. Practically, like without having that sort of model in place, I think using validating language around, like, I think anyone in this situation would have nervous system activation. They would feel really unsettled about this. They would feel fearful. You know, I'm like, vestibular symptoms can feel really unpredictable. They can feel out of control. And I've seen, or like the research shows, or however you want to put it, people find they're able to get back to doing the things that are important to them, or they're able to manage better when they meet with someone like a behavioral health specialist. So I find there's certain keywords that make people shut down. So like the anxiety piece, people are like glaze over. Psychologists sometimes glaze over. So when I worked in integrated care, we used the word behavioral health consultant a lot. And I don't mean that to say like you're trying to pull the wool over their eyes and like behavioral health consultant, like here's a psychologist. But I think if you can throw some other language in there, it can kind of soften it, because I know some people, when they hear the mental health piece or psychologist, like they just shut down and they're not open to it. The other piece about the testing and like things are normal, but they're not matching the symptoms. I think kind of a validating way to say that is, this is what our data is showing. However, our tests are limited, and your experience as a human being is going to be more sensitive than what our tests can capture. So let's figure out like what other type of referral would be helpful for you, rather than saying you're fine, your tests are normal, because then people are like, oh my gosh, I must be crazy. And so that kind of causes a whole sequela of other problems.
That's one thing we like to try and do, is when a patient has symptoms, but we cannot capture on a test what's happening, we like to talk to them about the idea of treating those symptoms, because they are experiencing that. That's real for them. So if we can treat those symptoms, does it matter what the test is even showing? And a lot of these tests are not sensitive for the types of diagnoses that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the first ENT I saw, I think I had some level of conductive hearing loss, which is common with superior canal dehiscence. And I remember telling him, like, I can't hear as well, but my hearing was normal. Mm-hmm. And it was very impactful. I remember even now, this was so many years ago, he said, you're more sensitive than what our test is able to capture. And so I was like, okay, so I'm not crazy.
Great way to say it.
Yeah.
This is real.
And it makes, as the patient, it makes such a difference when the provider can relate to you in that way, to speak to you in a way. We talk with our students about looking deeper at the test results. And sometimes that looking deeper is, our test can't capture what your symptoms are, what they're displaying. So we need to understand that as clinicians, that we have to talk to the patient, that it's an individual, it's not a test result in front of you. So treat that individual, and they're going to have a greater likelihood of success.
I think it can be triggering for people too, because a lot of people with vestibular disorders, this is their first kind of run-in with
healthcare
and not being able to go to the doctor, and like they know exactly what's going on and they give you this pill or whatever. And so that can feel very unsettling for people. And I think the limitations of medicine can feel very unsettling for people, of like, oh my gosh, there's not a test for this. Like, right. they can't definitively say this is what it is. And so kind of couching it in like, our tests have limitations and we're not able to capture it. However, that doesn't mean that your prognosis is poor or like there's
or that we can't help you.
Right. We're still able to help you.
We've had way too many people come in saying that they got a prescription for meclizine and out the door.
Mm-hmm. All the time. And you have VPPB and they really don't have VPPB and they're sitting there doing the epley over and over saying it makes them worse. Like I'm sure you see this all the time too, especially people who end up in the emergency room. Yeah. So there's definitely work to do when it comes to awareness.
That's for sure. And with the work you're doing, it really seems like you're trying to make a dent in creating that awareness and letting the public know that there are providers, there are specialties that can help you. And if you're looking at the whole body, that you're not just looking at the ear, it's not just audiology or neurology or ENT or primary care, but it's this holistic approach, there's going to be a good chance for success in, if you want to use the term remission or overcoming the symptoms or whatever it may be. And behavioral health is a significant component of that. So it really seems like you're doing a lot of good work out there that's helping a lot of people and going to continue to help a lot of people.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Before we go, tell everybody where they can find you so that if they're experiencing vestibular dysfunction or symptoms, or they just want to find out more about you and your journey and the work that you do, tell everybody where they can see you.
Yeah. So I'm most active on Instagram. So that's at Dr. Emily Pitstelnik. So I have two companies. I have a private practice that is thevestibularpsychologist.com. I'm licensed in 42 states, but for those who are not in those states, I have a sister company called Rooted Behavioral Education, where I oversee some mindset coaches. I have courses. I do kind of educational meetings, and that is available worldwide. So no matter where you are, we should be able to work together in some capacity, whether that's licensed or more under like an education or coaching
umbrella. And we'll link to all of that in the descriptors of the podcast. So Perfect. Thank you so much for your time and all your insightful information. And it really gives hope to people who are experiencing vestibular dysfunction that there's more to do than what they may be encountering in their physician's offices.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly kind of like my tagline, or the thing I always say is I don't want anyone to feel like they've tried everything. Because you definitely haven't. Like, there are always more things to try. And that might
look like,
yeah, exactly. That might look like things off the beaten path, but some of the things that have helped me the most have been off the beaten path. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time and your expertise and sharing it with our audience. We greatly appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.